just so you know, this is not a sermon on marriage or gender roles or anything like that. And just to be a little provocative, especially if you grew up in the church or you like Proverbs, that woman in chapter 31 is not who you think she is. We'll end there in a few minutes. That is not who you think she is. That passage is one of the most abused passages in the church today in Proverbs. And so we will come back to that at the end. If you were not here last week, this is the second part of a sermon on wisdom, not originally intended to be two parts, but there's just so much to do with wisdom. Next week, we're going to do a sermon on the fear of the Lord, which you heard when Ryan read it. The fear of the Lord is arguably the central theme in wisdom literature, because not to be corny, but as we move into St. Paul's, which is so different than this place, it's darker, it's bigger, it's a church and beautiful stained glass windows. We're realizing that we need a lot of wisdom to figure out how to set up well in there. And so the mic went out a couple of times last week. And so even for those of you who are here, you maybe didn't hear some of this sermon all that well. If you weren't here, you certainly don't have a chance to listen to it online because we need to figure out how to record well over there. I will do a very quick review of what we did last week and then we'll move on. But I want to, one way to think about the sermon today is that I hope that it gives you a lot of motivation to dig into Proverbs this summer. It's really a crash course on how to read the book of Proverbs. Wisdom literature in the Old Testament is primarily a reference to four books. Proverbs is the most obvious, and it is the most general and broad, but Job is a wisdom book. Wisdom for not just when suffering happens, but when senseless suffering that makes absolutely no sense. No run, what do you do when you cannot understand why the world is falling apart the way it has? Job is wisdom for how to cope with that. Ecclesiastes, when you are young, if many of you are, and you have so much ambition and desire and optimism for the future, and as you try one road after another, sex and money and power and drugs and rock and roll and friendship and this and this and this, and all of them come up short, and you're still as unhappy as you were before you started, what do you do with that? What do you do with the exhaustion, the weariness, the cynicism that kicks in as you get older in life? I've often said to a number of you and to a number of friends of mine, I'm 44, so I'm like exactly kind of like middle age. I have found that in the last, I don't know, 8 to 10 years of my life, that one of the greatest challenges of getting older is that the future can't mean to you what it meant when you were younger. So much of when I was younger, my motivation on a daily basis is what I perceived the future might mean. And you hit a certain point where you're like, the future is now. And this is not what I thought it was going to be when I was younger. What do you do with that? Ecclesiastes is about that. Song of Songs is the fourth book. And that's about sex and about relationships and marriage. In the New Testament, probably the closest we have to a wisdom book in the New Testament would be the book of James, written by the brother of Jesus. Although there are wisdom elements to many other books in the Old Testament and the New Testament. Here is basically, and I put it in the bulletin again, so if you see the sermon under the message title, Wisdom, a Journey, and a Romance, that's what we'll look at. Last week, I began to break down some of these categories. Here are the three that I got through, especially last week. The wisdom is creational. That is, keep reading Proverbs. By wisdom, God created the world. That wisdom is like in Proverbs chapter 8, like an architect, like an engineer, like a master workman that God consulted when he made creation, which is described as being like a house that has structure, but also he filled it. And when we encounter the world, wisdom theology encourages us to see that just as you went into this building and you had a sense of like stairs are for going up and chairs are for sitting, everything we encounter in creation has a place and it has a purpose. And wisdom teaches us to see the contours, the texture of creation. But wisdom is also covenantal. That is, it's also about relationship with God and keeping faith and keeping faithfulness with other people and with even animals and the inhabitants of the world and the environment. That wisdom is something where someone who is wise has a sense that there's something bigger outside of them that they are beholden to. Someone who is wise has a sense of obligation. They don't just wake up saying, I got a lot of desires, how can I fulfill them? And then just run ramshod over creation. Someone who is wise has a sense that I want to keep covenant with God. If you listen, when I think it was Nancy in chapter 2, that the forbidden woman, the negative woman, which we'll look at in a bit, that she has forgotten her covenant with God. That there's obligations and promises. And foolishness is not just going the wrong direction, it's actually turning away from covenant. It's turning away from a relationship that's already there. And then wisdom is contextual. We looked last week at a number of examples that there's a great line from Montaigne, the French humanist, when he says, whereas I can be knowledgeable with another person's knowledge, I can never be wise with another person's wisdom. A wise person not just knows that this is true and this is false, and knows that this is true and this is true and this is true, but knows when to pull out a certain truth, knows when a truth is not relevant, knows when a danger is particularly important, knows when a danger is not important. A wise person knows how to use knowledge, knows how to use truth. And so I concluded last week by saying that a wise person or wisdom is these three things, and they correlate the creation covenant in context, that a wise person has perception of God's ordering creation. They notice that, oh, stairs are over there, chairs are over here, this is for this, this is for this. They see God's purposes and designs everywhere, but they don't just see them, they also participate in them. They actually sit in chairs and don't pick chairs up and hit people in chairs. They actually participate in the order, but they also know how to practically apply in every situation. So perception, participation, practical application of God's order. So wisdom is certainly cognition. A wise person absolutely sees things that someone who is not wise does not see. But it's much more than cognition. It also has to do with the will, that a wise person is willing to submit to the order that's there. I could be stubborn and say, well, that door's over there, but I didn't ask anybody to make a door there. So I'm going to go out the wall, and I could just keep running my body into the wall and have just a huge welt on my forehead. A wise person actually participates in the order that's there with their will. But it's also, when I used this illustration last week, if you were here, wisdom is also a skill. It's like improv. A wise person knows what the right response in the right moment is. They know how to react. They know how not to react. And so wisdom is all of these things. I want to read you, it was in the bulletin last week. I'll send it around again. The single best summary of wisdom I've ever come across is by this. I've recommended it a few times in this series, The Grammar of Faith. The last topic in the world you think would be compelling and really interesting to read about theologically would be sin. But one of the most invigorating theology books I've ever read is a book on sin by Cornelius Plantinga called Not the Way It's Supposed to Be. And we need to listen to his description of wisdom. In the literature of Scripture, wisdom is, broadly speaking, the knowledge of God's world and the knack of fitting oneself into it. The wise person knows creation. She knows its boundaries and its limits. She understands its laws and its rhythms. She discerns its times and its seasons. She respects its great dynamics. She understands that creation possesses its own integrity and significance, quite apart from her claim on it, and quite apart from any possibility that creation will make her happy. The wise person gives into creation and gives into God. And she does the first, giving into creation, because she does the second, because she gives into God. She knows that the earth is the Lord's, and so is its fullness. She knows some of the deep grains and textures of the world, because she knows some of the ways and habits of its maker. In the biblical view, the wise are righteous, and the righteous are wise. These are people who love and fear God. We'll come to that next week. Affirm God's world, live gladly within its borders, and make music there according to divine time and key signatures. Last week, I used the illustration of being in tune with the harmony in the song of creation. The wise are always in order. Insofar as they live right, they also live well. And so wisdom is a reality-based phenomenon. To be wise is to know reality, to discern it for what it is. A discerning person notices things, attends to things, picks up on things. Discernment is a mark of wisdom. It shows a kind of attentive respect and fondness for reality. The discerning person notices the differences between things, but also the connections between things. She knows creation. She knows what God has put together and what God has kept asunder, and can therefore spot the fractures and the alloys introduced by human violation of it. The really discerning person, the one whose discernment marks out genuine wisdom, does not merely inspect reality or analyze it. The one who discerns also loves it. At some level, she affirms the reality she knows and commits herself to it as it is. To be wise is to know and to affirm reality, to discern it, and then to speak and act accordingly. The wise accommodate themselves to reality. And so here is a very much more basic definition of wisdom. Wisdom is saying or doing the right thing at the right time to or with the right person in the right circumstances. Is somebody who, one of the images that you see a lot in Proverbs is that wisdom is like a word spoken fittingly in season. Have you ever had a friend who just always knows, whether you're down or whether you're excited, knows exactly what to say to you? You always feel like they have a timely word. A wise person is like that. And so before we go to the other ones, that wisdom is curious, it's countercultural, it's corrected, it's Christ-centered. What I want to do is go back to Proverbs 1. And I want you to see something that is often missed. For those who love Proverbs, and I'll be honest, I am not a guy. Proverbs is not a top 20 book for me. Some of you, Proverbs is very top of the list. Aphorisms and little principles and little nuggets, not really my thing. Proverbs has never been high on my list. But some of you love Proverbs, and we should. We should love Proverbs. But I also think people who love Proverbs also tend to like self-help books. And they tend to like 8 steps to doing this and 9 steps to doing that. And I think there's always something really fragile and suspect about those approaches. And so what I want you to see above all else today is the narrative framework that all of the individual Proverbs come in. And so here's the most important thing I want you to see. The book of Proverbs, every individual aphorism and saying takes place in a story. In the passages that Ryan and Nancy read, you were introduced to 5 characters. And I bet you didn't even notice. You were introduced to a father and a mother. You were introduced to a son, and you were introduced to 2 women, one of whom is associated with wisdom, the other of whom is associated with foolishness. Here is, and this is why, there are 2 metaphors, and so often when we read Proverbs today, we don't read them as metaphors, we read them literally. Let me say this first. There are 2 overall sections to Proverbs. Even turn there with me. Proverbs 1-9 is the introduction to the book. Very few individual sayings that you associate later on, the wise do this, the wicked do this, the righteous do this, the fools do this, take place in 1-9. Instead, what you get is a repeated narrative framework of kind of like in the age, not to embarrass them or embarrass Taekwon and Ernest are right at that age where they're not kids anymore, but they're in college and they're on the way to adulthood. The book of Proverbs, and let me back up and say another thing real quick. Every guy in the room who's a Christian knows that as weird as it might seem at first, part of being a Christian is learning to identify yourself as the bride of Christ. Taking on a female role with respect to God, with respect to Christ. The son in the book of Proverbs, ladies, you are also the son here. Every single person is the son here. The son is, I mentioned this very briefly last week, ultimately there's only 2 categories of people, according to wisdom literature. Wise, fools, righteous, wicked. But there's another sense in which there's 3. That is someone young who is described alternatively as simple, gullible, naive. That is, on the one hand, there's something negative about that, but this person is very prone to going the wrong direction, very easily deceived. It would not be a surprise if this person goes off the rails. On the other hand, they are not yet wise, not yet foolish. They are, so to speak, a free agent still. That's the son. He is no longer a kid. He is about to, and this is in an ancient cultural context, but he's about to leave home as he goes into adulthood. And his mom and his dad are giving him 1 last mom and dad speech. Remember all the stuff we taught. Look out for this. Look out for this. Remember this. Do this. Do this. And as he goes out, he meets 2 women who both invite him into a romantic relationship. And the dad and the mom are telling him, you want to end up with this kind of woman. You do not want to end up with that kind of woman. And one of the biggest mistakes we make is this is not for guys to literally think about the women that you date or you don't date. You marry, you don't marry. This is all of us to put ourselves in the shoes of the son and to think about as we, and these are my 2 metaphors, because we are a church that is overwhelmingly young, and I would guess for sure, if not overwhelmingly, at least the majority of you are not married, Because we are young and single as a church, we, more than most churches, are prone to be like, hey, I'm young, I'm single. This speaks directly to me, but this speaks to Stephen Romeo. This speaks to me. This speaks to old people. This speaks to married people. Every single one of us, young, old, male, female, is the son. And so here are the two metaphors that Proverbs uses for becoming a wise person. It's like a journey from being a kid to being an adult. It's like going from being single to getting married, to getting hitched. It's like falling in love. Becoming an adult, falling in love are the two main metaphors for the book of Proverbs for becoming wise. And if you notice, I'll point your attention to it again. In chapter one, after a brief introduction that Ryan read for us, Lady Wisdom, I'm going to call her that, appears for the first time in chapter 1, verse 20. Wisdom cries aloud in the street. Now, you might think at that point it's just an abstraction, but keep listening. In the markets, she raises her voice. This is a woman. At the head of the noisy streets, she cries out. Jump ahead to chapter 2. After, and almost every speech in Proverbs 1 through 9 starts with, my son. My son, as the father and the mother, can they remember this? Don't do this. Hold on to this. All this stuff. In chapter 2, the warnings crystallize in verse 16. So, if you pursue wisdom, if you stay away from foolishness, so you will be delivered from the forbidden woman, from the adulteress with her smooth speech. This is not an actual woman. This is a metaphor for folly. Just like there is a woman who represents wisdom, there is a woman who represents foolishness. And this is not an actual woman. This is not a book for guys. Again, one of the challenges of Proverbs, even the ladies, you are the son, and you are being propositioned by two different women who are inviting you into a relationship. Just like guys, we are the bride of Christ, and we are being pursued by Jesus. Over and over and over again in Proverbs 1 through 9, basically it alternates between these two women. You meet Lady Folly and you get a description of her, you are reintroduced to Lady Wisdom. Let's look at two other places where we see her. Chapter 3, look down at verse 13. Blessed is the one who finds wisdom and the one who gets understanding. Why? Because the gain from her, not from it, from her, is better than the gain from silver. There's one of your first clues to the woman at the end of the book is not who you think she is. Because this is something that is said about the woman at the end of the book. And her profit is better than gold. She is more precious than jewels. And son, there is nothing you can desire that can compare with her. Long life is in her right hand. In her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are ways of pleasantness. And all of her paths are peace. She is a tree of life. First time this has appeared since Genesis 2 and 3. She is a tree of life to those who lay hold of her. Those who hold her fast, they are called blessed. Why? Because the Lord by wisdom founded the earth. And by understanding, he established the heavens. By his knowledge, the deeps broke open and the clouds dropped down the dew. So my son, do not lose sight of this. This is the woman you want to end up with. Chapter 5, starting in verse 1. My son, and I'm only giving you a couple of examples, but I'd love for you to read chapters 1 through 9 and notice how these two women dominate what the son encounters as he leaves home for the first time as an about-to-be adult. My son, chapter 5, verse 1. Be attentive to my wisdom, your mom, your dad. Incline your ear to my understanding so that you may keep discretion and your lips may guard knowledge. Why? Because the lips of a forbidden woman drip honey. And her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is as bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps follow the path to Sheol. Literally, the difference between Lady Wisdom and Lady Foolishness is the difference between life and death for Proverbs. She does not ponder the path of life. Her ways wander, even though she does not know it. And now, O sons, and there's a good indication, every once in a while it goes plural. This is all of us, including the women. Keep your way far from her. Do not go near the door of her house. Now, jump ahead to chapter 9. And chapter 9 ends the framework of the book. And before I read chapter 9, just if you glance ahead, look how chapter 10, verse 1 is started with a heading. The Proverbs of Solomon. You don't actually start running into Solomon's Proverbs until chapter 10, verse 1. All of 1 through 9 is the narrative framework. You are supposed to hear every individual proverb in 10 through 31 through. If you want to dig into this more in the future, maybe we can have a conversation another time. Chapters 10 through 31 are themselves broken up into 7 sections, like the 7 days of creation. But chapter 1 through 9, there's no direct wisdom there specifically. It's just a story that we are to get into our head. Chapter 9 ends with this. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn her 7 pillows. And there's about to be 7 sections of wisdom that we're going to run into. She has slaughtered her beasts. She has mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has sent out her young women to call. From the highest places in the town, if you know the Old Testament, the high places are where worship happens, whether true worship or idolatry. And so Lady Wisdom is associated with true worship. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. I know this might be not what you're expecting, but she is propositioning the young son. I got a nice house. I got a meal here. Come on in. She is inviting him into a relationship. And to him who lacks sense, she says, come, eat of my bread, and drink of the wine I have mixed. Guys, you know this. If a girl asks you to grab a meal, that's unusual. There is something really interesting that is happening right there. This is a woman that invites him to come into her house and have a meal. But what it means is you need to leave your simple ways and live and walk in the way of insight. Whoever corrects a scoffer gets himself abuse. And he who reproves a wicked man incurs injury. So do not reprove a scoffer or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, he will love you. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will become still wiser. Teach a righteous man, he will increase in learning. And here's what's known as an inclusio. It begins and ends, chapters 1 through 9, with this. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That's the entire sermon next week. What is this? And the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. For by me, this woman who's inviting you into a relationship, all of us, including the women in the room, by me, your days will be multiplied, for years will be added to your life. If you are wise, you are wise for yourself. If you scoff, you alone will bear it. That's, I think, what Montaigne is saying. I can't do this for you. You can hear another foolish person, but it's up to you whether you're foolish or not. You can hear a wise person. Sorry, I shouldn't have pointed at myself as a wise. You can hear any wise person. It is up to you whether you become wiser. Then, the woman folly, she's loud. She's seductive. She knows nothing. She sits at the door of her house. She takes a seat on the highest places of the town. Notice the parallels with Lady Wisdom. And she calls, just like Lady Wisdom called, to those who pass by, who are going straight on their way. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. And to him who lacks sense, she says, same thing Lady Wisdom said in verse 4. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. To him who lacks sense, she says, stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he does not know that the dead are in this woman's house, that her guests are in the depths of Sheol. So here's the book of Proverbs. You're a guy, even the ladies, you're 16, 18, 20 years old. It can be culturally flexible from moment to moment, but you're not a kid anymore, but you're not quite an adult, and you're leaving your parents' house, whether to go to college, whether to move away and get a job, and your parents are, I don't mean in a negative way, but they are concerned because they know how easily you could be led astray, how easily it could go off the rails. And so they are reminding you of what you've learned. They are encouraging you to be aware of what you will find. And they are most of all saying there are two kinds of women you're going to meet out there. Please marry this kind of woman. Don't marry this one. And every individual proverb comes to us in that context. And so I want us to look at our last 4 C words for wisdom in light of this. That becoming wise is like going on a journey from childhood to adulthood. It's like going from singleness to falling in love and getting married, that wisdom and wise people are curious. Here is something that I'll bet you all know and you remember, whether you're all, I think, for the most part, old enough to have, at least none of you, I think, are in any straightforward way still kids. Some of you are clearly adults. Some of you are in between. Some of you are single. Some of you are in relationships or married. But you all know that one thing that going from being a child to an adult, going from single to being in a relationship sharing common, is that if you show up in either situation as a know-it-all, you are in trouble. If a kid who goes on his first date ever is like, I'm an expert, this kid is not going to do well. If somebody goes off to college being like, I know everything, my parents are so dumb, the world so simple, this is someone who is set up for disaster. Being curious, being open to learning, not imposing your desire onto the world, but having a real open hand to this, to what is coming, and being willing to be flexible, to grow, to be transformed, to become something you're not now, is central to this. I think one of the reasons probably the writer of Proverbs uses going on a journey from being a child to an adult, falling in love, going from singleness to marriage, is that both of these areas, when we're younger and even potentially when we're older, are characterized by, I don't want to say it's a paradox, but by one positive, one negative, by wonder and attraction, and by overwhelming fear. What if I marry the wrong person? Being an adult is a really hard thing. What if I don't find the right job? What if this? As you're going from being a kid to an adult, single to married, you are often overwhelmed with a sense of being out of your league and being vulnerable and being susceptible to missteps. But you're also, you remember this when you're a kid? Couldn't wait to grow up. You remember this when you're single and you meet somebody, you're so excited about what a relationship might bring? There is wonder and attraction, but there is fear, and both of those are appropriate. Someone who is like, oh, whatever, I'm numb, I'm bored. Like, that's not what life is supposed to be like. But somebody who is cocky, that's also a mistake. It is a mark of wisdom that you have a kind of tentativeness. You don't have self-confidence. You have confidence in what your parents taught you. You have confidence in the world that God made. But you're not walking around being like, I got this. Anybody who walks into these situations being like, I got this, is a sucker. And other people are going to see this and they're going to take advantage. I would guess that one of the differences between these metaphors, but it still kind of correlates, is that when parents send a child who's about to become an adult into the world, wise parents are going to tell the kid, there are a lot of people out there that do not love you like we love you. There are a lot of people out there who will actively try to take advantage of you. There are people out there who will pose as this, but they will turn out to be this. And you are in danger of being deceived by what is going on out there in a way that you never were in the home. When somebody goes from being single to falling in love, the great danger there is that because you want it so much, because desire is so strong, that's self-deception. People often end up in relationships because desire leads wisdom, and then they get ruined or at least hurt because they end up in a relationship that was driven by their own self-deception. They weren't aware of their own desires. They weren't aware of their own incompleteness and neediness, and therefore they jump ahead to something that's not wise. This is what it's like becoming a wise person. There's dangers, but there's attraction. You have to seek it, but you need to be careful. All of it. So the wise are curious. C.S. Lewis, a lot of you will remember that in the Chronicles of Narnia, one of the final books is called The Magician's Nephew. Never read these. They're great books to read. I loved reading these. Taekwon and Ernest when they were young. I still go back and reread them myself every once in a while. Does anybody remember who the magician is in the title The Magician's Nephew? It's Uncle Andrew, who is not a magician. He's a scientist. And yet everyone keeps calling him a magician, and it bothers him to no end. C.S. Lewis says this, and it's a quote at the beginning of the bulletin. He says this later in The Abolition of Man. Some people love this about C.S. Lewis. Some people hate this about C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, whenever he wrote fiction, the fiction was serving the ideas. Most fiction writers would see that as a bad move. C.S. Lewis is writing stories in order to embody ideas. And C.S. Lewis said, modern people are overwhelmingly inclined to see science in our age and culture as the antithesis to magic in the ancient world. But often, science in our culture plays the same role as magic in the ancient world. And here's what he means by that. There is something which unites magic in the ancient world and applied science today while separating both from the wisdom of earlier ages. For the wise men and women of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality. And the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue, all very central in Proverbs. But for magic, ancient world, applied science, our world alike, the problem is seen as how can we subdue reality to the wishes of human beings. The solution is a technique, and in both the practice of this technique, we are ready to do things that have hitherto been regarded as disgusting and impious. Now, C.S. Lewis, if you read a larger context, he's not against science, but he's saying science should help us discover the world so that we can respond to it. It shouldn't be a tool for making the world what we want it to be. And insofar as science becomes a technique for turning the world into what I already have a desire for, it actually becomes our version of magic. That's what you go to a magician for, to get you what you don't otherwise have access to. Your desire doesn't change, the world changes. The wise person, the world stays the same. My desires and my character change as that happened. Just to give another example, Hugh Laurie, who played Dr. House in the TV show, as far as I know, not a Christian. I was watching an interview with him a couple of months ago, and he's talking about a show that he did later on where he plays another doctor. He's basically like a psychiatrist and dealing with mental health. And he's talking in the interview about how we often perceive that we can do whatever we want and there will be no consequences. And if there's consequences in our physical health and our mental health, we're like, man, it's like magic. Who knows why I'm depressed? Who knows why, you know, I have high cholesterol, even though I'm eating Big Macs, you know, 10 times a day. And he says this: I think it's important that people speak up for truth over sentiment, truth over feeling. It seems like we are about to be drowned in this feeling that the world is endlessly remakeable in my own head, to be what I want it to be, that in my own head I can wish upon a star. A wise person knows that's not true. A kid who approaches going into adulthood still living in fairy tales is going to be a disastrous adult. It's okay when you're a kid. You need to leave that behind as you become an adult. Somebody who is projecting, and I'll just say as a guy, I know this is a guy who projects onto a real life woman all of the infantile fantasies he had about women before he met her is setting him and her up for disaster. We do not live by desire and fantasy, we live by reality and by wisdom. And so in both of these metaphors, becoming an adult, falling in love, being curious, being open, not showing up as a know-it-all is absolutely central. Wisdom is also countercultural. We looked at this very briefly last week. 1 Corinthians 1 through 4 is the great passage here. I'll also say this, I prayed this after the sermon last week. Maybe the most famous wisdom statement in the New Testament is James 1, 5. Anyone lacks wisdom, let him just ask God, who gives generously. So here's this great prayer and promise that we often take advantage of, which is true. I would encourage you later to go back and read everything that's around that statement in James. James 1, 2 through 4, right before it, rejoice when you are in temptations and trials, because God is about to do something amazing in your life. Afterwards, if you are rich, be scared. If you are poor, rejoice. And then afterwards, blessed is the man. Everything around James 1 is profoundly countercultural. None of us rejoice when we come upon trials. None of us think, this dude just hit it rich. What a disaster. Nobody thinks, oh, you're poor. What an opportunity. None of us think that, because wisdom is deeply countercultural. And so one of the things that this metaphor illumines is that when you're a kid, and this is both exciting and scary, so much of what being an adult turns out to be is not at all what you expected, not at all what you could anticipate. When you fall in love, when you go from being single to being in a relationship, both in good ways and in hard ways, it is so often not what your instincts set you up to think it would be. You need to be aware of this, that wisdom will also often come to you going against the grain of your instincts. If you trust your instincts deeply, you will be a fool. I'm not saying throw your hands up by your instincts, but do not give them the status that only the voice of God should have in our lives. Our instincts are so often proven to be wrong. I said this briefly last week. If you don't believe this, I would just say, go read the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7, which Jesus ends with an allusion to Proverbs 9. The person who builds his house by doing my words is like the man who built his house on the rock. The person who only hears my words but doesn't do them is like the person who is a fool, and it's going to come down. How you relate to your enemies, how you relate to your own sexual desire, how you relate to money, how you relate to persecution, how you relate to all these things. I don't think there's a single thing in the Sermon on the Mount that if we started with our own instincts and desires, we'd be like, yeah, Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount is profoundly counterintuitive and countercultural, and yet it is the essence of wisdom. And so here's the third one. When I say it's corrected, what I mean by this is that James chapter 3 is another place you could go. There is a wisdom that comes down from above. There is a wisdom that, this is strong language in James 3, that is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. So there are things out there, and this is the point of Proverbs 1 through 9 with these two women. Both women look attractive. Both women seem like they have something to offer. There are two kinds of wisdom out there. Only one is actually wisdom. The other is actually foolishness, and it raises, and you can't trust your instincts because it's often countercultural. It raises the million-dollar question, how do you know the difference? How do you know which woman is calling you into her house? You can't look at your desires and be like, well, I want that one, so that's wisdom. You can't just listen to what your parents said because they can't do it for you, and tradition is often wrong. It's certainly incomplete. So how do you know the difference? And because we're going to get into this next week, I'm not going to say much, this is where the fear of the Lord becomes central. That tradition, reason, experience, all of them are important to a person who is wise. None of them are where you get your bearings. John Calvin used to say that, yes, the world is ordered by God. Yes, it's wise. Yes, it's beautiful. But both because we are broken by sin subjectively and because the ravages of sin are seen out there in the world objectively, it is now just true that if you lie relentlessly, you will often get ahead. And if you tell the truth, you will often suffer. That is now true of our world. Not always, but sometimes. It is often true that if you use people for what you want, you will often seem like you're doing well for years, even decades. And if you serve other people in humility, you will often not be recognized and you will feel lonely. What do you do with this? And Calvin says, what we need is the spectacles of Scripture to come in to get the world into focus. And so someone who is wise is someone who doesn't look to what their mom and their dad said or their culture said, even a Christian culture. They're not somebody who looks at their own cultural and individual sense of reason and logic. They're not someone who looks at their own experience and desire. They're someone who fears the Lord. They're someone who says, what does God intend in this situation? What does God want in this situation? Someone who is wise is, and this is so obviously one of the big repeated themes in Proverbs, someone who is wise is open to being corrected. Someone who is wise will often course correct. Will often not just dig in their heels and keep going the direction they're going, but they will learn from their mistakes. They will admit their mistakes when they make them, and they will be open to learning above all else from God. There is a great line in a John Cusack movie, I think it's High Fidelity, where the whole story is about how he's just ruined one romantic relationship after another over the course of life. And in this movie, he's maybe my age, maybe a little younger, and he's got this aha moment, this revelatory moment where he says, for years, I've been following my guts, and I've finally learned my guts have got crap for brains. And it's a great, great lesson to learn about life. Is someone who is wise is ultimately oriented towards their creator. And then it's Christ-centered. And here, just with our two metaphors, it's like becoming an adult. It's like falling in love. What does it mean to be a Christian? According to the New Testament, it means becoming mature. It means growing into your full humanity. It means bearing the image of God more fully than you ever did before. And it's getting engaged to a bride. It's getting married to Jesus with the rest of us, that Jesus is the epitome of wisdom. Jesus is the one through whom God created the world. Jesus is the one whose teachings never lead us astray. And so in Colossians 2, we could quote so many verses, but in Colossians 2, Paul reminds the Colossians, in Jesus, that's where all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hidden. They're all there. You just have to unpack them. But they're all there. And so let's end by going to Proverbs 31. And maybe you can guess what I'm going to do with this. But this woman, I said at the beginning, is not who you think she is. Chapter 31 starts, verses 1 through 9, not with a dad, but with a mom. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. And I love this first line. Every parent knows this instinct. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? Worry, anxiety. We all know this from parents. For those of you who become parents in the future, you'll feel it. And just give some instructions. And then in verse 10, I'm convinced one of the great misunderstood passages, an excellent wife who can find. I'm like, why is Proverbs ending with a description of the kind of girl you should date and marry? That's obviously an important theme, but Proverbs is about so much more because it's not. Because this is the happily ever after ending if you pursue wisdom. So let me just put it very briefly. If you pursue wisdom, if you seek her, if you acquire her, and if you cling to her, what a good wife will do for her husband, wisdom will do for you. She is far more precious than jewels. You can do this on your own later if you want. Every single description of the wife in Proverbs 31 has earlier showed up as a description of wisdom. Wisdom is far more precious than jewels. The heart of those who seek wisdom, they can trust in wisdom and will have no lack of gain. Wisdom does the one who is wise good and not harm all the days of her life. She opens her hand, verse 20, to the poor, reaches her hand out to the needy. That's what wisdom does. And love, verse 21, she is not afraid of snow when it snows because all of her household are already clothed in thick clothing. I love verse 25, strength and dignity are her clothing. She laughs at the time to come. Because she knows the Creator, and she knows what the world is like, not because there won't be surprises, not because she won't suffer, but because wisdom equips us to walk through the world well, to walk through the world the way we need. It is probably true, I think. Feel free to come up to me afterwards if it's not true. Men and women, both in a good relationship romantically, they both get things from each other. I think it's probably true that men just get a whole lot more from women than women get from us. Men, like, get civilized by women. Men, like, learn how to be human beings for women that they're in relationships with. And it's one of the reasons that I think it's here. Now, ladies, this is also true for you. One of the reasons parents worry about the transition from childhood to adulthood and the transition from being single to a romantic partner is we know from our own lives and from observation, man, so much of the rest of this person's life is going to hang on the decisions they make in this area. And here, the point is not, guys, here's a good description of the kind of girl you should look for. That is not at all what Proverbs 31 is about. The point is all of us, as the son who is moving from childhood to adulthood, who is potentially moving from singleness to being in a relationship, this is the woman you want to end up with. This is the woman whose invitation you want to say yes to. This is the woman you want to put a ring on her finger and marry because she will bless you for the rest of your life in a way that you cannot imagine right now. And so this is how all of us should aspire to wisdom. Like this young son aspires, and especially is encouraged by his parents, end up with this woman, not with this woman. The alternatives are, with respect to being a child, arrested development, just being perpetually an adolescent, and the other is to either end up in a miserable marriage or to be flaky and to jump from relationship to relationship. And when you're young, that stuff is like, oh, I want to keep my options open. It's my choice anyway. But as you get older, you see, it makes all the difference in the world which of those two paths you choose. It makes all the difference in the world. And this is the story in which we pursue wisdom. And so I'm going to say one last thing, and then I'm just going to appeal to you. Prize wisdom. Seek wisdom. Care about it more than money. Care about it more than sex. Care about it more than status and recognition. Pursue it. Make it the priority of your life. Ultimately, one of the things that Proverbs is often misunderstood is that it's often understood that if I do A, then B will happen. It's often known as the act consequence scheme. And some people think that's why Job and Ecclesiastes are written, because this turns out to not be true. I don't think Job and Ecclesiastes are critiquing Proverbs. They're just applying it to another specific area, suffering and getting older and cynicism. I would say, and I'm just following many other scholars here, I would say Proverbs does not hold out an act consequence scheme. It holds out a character is destiny scheme. And as you are young, moving into adulthood, as you are single, moving into a relationship, your destiny will be your character. And if you are wise, and if you trust in God, if you love God and you love your neighbor, I'm not saying that you won't be totally surprised by what comes. You will be, but it will be good. And you will be equipped for it. And if you just follow your desires or the instincts of your culture, we will so often go astray. This is ultimately what wisdom is. It encourages us to become wise. And for all of us, whether we are 70 years old or whether we're 18, we are the son who is about to enter the world. And the great desire is, I want to be a mature adult. I want to meet the right girl. That should be true of all of us. That's what it's like to become wise. So let's pray.